Welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 9. This is Nick here with Frank. How you doing, Frank?
Hello. Hey.
And this week we're very excited. We've got a good show coming up. We are going to start off talking about the new trailer releases from this week. It felt like trailer week. And then we are going to get into this week's film of the week, which is Ridley Scott's The Counselor. And we're going to do top 5 performances from Brad Pitt and Cameron Diaz, who are both featured in The Counselor. And if time permits, we'll talk about any sort of viewings we had during the week. So we'll get right into it right off the bat. One other trailer, Frank. I know we were during our preamble. Did you have a chance to watch the Good Dinosaur trailer?
I did not.
Okay, so we can talk about that one at another date. Definitely looks cute, but we've had some big trailer releases this week. One of them being the new film Everest, which is coming out in October, and it has a huge cast: Jason Clarke, Jake Gyllenhaal. Trying to think about who else is in it right off the top of my head. We have
Josh Brolin.
Yep, that was the other big one. And it's a true story of guys who summited Everest and then have to deal with a massive storm that's coming their way. Looks, from what I can tell, very impressive on a physical scale. I'd be curious to see it's from the director of some rather entertaining but sort of undemanding movies, Contraband. And I'm trying to think what the other one was the guy just did. He did Contraband, and he did Two Guns, which was entertaining, with Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington. This looks like a much more big, sort of huge, epically scaled film. This looks sort of like his coming out, maybe, as a filmmaker. Balthasar Kormákartó, I think is how you say his name. You think he's a Hungarian director, if I'm not mistaken. I know he's European in some fashion, but it looks very intense, I thought, from the trailer. What did you think of the Everest trailer?
I liked it a lot. I like the cast. I love Brolin, Gyllenhaal. I'm looking forward to it. It was an intense trailer, and it looks like one of those Hollywood disaster films, but better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's kind of the vibe I got while watching it, like Day After Tomorrow or some disaster film, but it just looks like it has more teeth and more edge to it. It kind of reminded me of The Gray.
Yes.
In a way.
Yeah, it looks like you're going to get sort of the survival, the intestinal fortitude type material guys that get men against the elements. John Hawkes, I noticed, is in there. Keira Knightley playing Jason Clarke's, I think, wife at home. So she looks like she has like the Sienna Miller role, if you will, for this year. It definitely looks very solid and, like you said, thrilling in a disaster-related way. Another big trailer for this week, Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies, which looks off the bat, I thought, very solid. Definitely sort of the material that you would expect Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks to knock out of the park. I'm not sure if you noticed that it was co-written by the Coen brothers.
Right,
which sort of continues their interesting, writing big screenplays after doing Unbroken, having a hand in that last year. So this is the second year in a row where they have a big sort of period piece with their names on it, at least as part of the creative team. And this is the true story of an American pilot, a reconnaissance pilot, who's apparently shot down over Soviet Union. Right? Isn't that what this is about? And they have to,
yes,
they have to trade. I mean, we have one of theirs, and they have one of ours, so we're going to trade them. I got the initial impression that I got from the trailer is that it felt like a stylistic companion piece to Munich in a way.
Yeah, I think so, too. I thought Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy,
yes,
also,
yeah,
when I was definitely watching the trailer. And to hit on what you said, it does look like this would be a Spielberg-Hanks film, and this would be expected to be a Spielberg-Hanks film, and I'll go see it. I like Spielberg and Hanks. I just wish they would try something new.
Yeah. Yeah,
not a period piece, old America. I mean, not to take anything away from it. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I just, like you said, it looks like a film you'd expect them to make.
Mm-hmm.
And
familiar.
Right, a familiar film, like you have seen it before, or it's, yeah, exactly, familiar is the perfect word for it. I just want Spielberg to do something off the beaten path of what he normally does. And I'm sure he'll do that one day. But yeah, that's, anyway. Yeah, I liked it. I liked the trailer.
Yeah, I would say that that you echoed, you know, my response. Visually, I think it looks really exciting. And that always, of course, appeals to me right off the bat. But yes, I agree. Would love to see Spielberg sort of get down and dirty, make something a little more, you know, like you said, maybe experimental, off the beaten path, unexpected. But for what it is, looks out. Also got a, you know, Good Shepherd vibe, too. You know, there's some of that going on in there, maybe, too.
Right. I love how, speaking of Good Shepherd, by the way, I saw that, well, of course I saw that before I saw Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Duh. But it was before I knew what Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was. And I own both. I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is a masterpiece.
Me too.
I like Good Shepherd a lot. I'll rewatch that every so often, but
me
it's
too.
Just funny that Good Shepherd is the American version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. You know what I mean?
Pretty much,
that's,
yeah.
That's essentially what it boils down to. But I do enjoy both. But yeah, that's a good comparison.
And then we got another big trailer for Robert Zemeckis' The Walk, which is based on the life of Philip Petit, who did the just absolutely ridiculous scaling of the walking across of the World Trade Center back in the 70s. Have you seen Man on Wire, the documentary?
I have seen Man on Wire. Very good.
So it'll be tough for the film to come close to Man on Wire just because of how amazing that film was and how, you know, real a lot of that footage was, because clearly they had an amazing amount of footage. And the recreations that were done for Man on Wire were thrilling. This looks like you're going to have to bring a barf bag to the theater. I mean, I had sweaty palms just looking at it on my computer, and I'm afraid of heights. There's definitely a vertigo sensation that I get when I'm in a plane sometimes. This, to me, looks like it's going to scare the crap out of me.
Yeah, I have the same issue with heights. I'm fine on a plane because I feel stabilized and I can move and walk around. But I've, you know, going up elevators to really tall buildings, I have an issue with heights. And this movie the trailer does make me phobic, or arise my phobicy.
Yeah, it looks like an anxiety filled sort of entertainment.
Right. It's just interesting. I love the documentary. I feel like I don't have the desire to see this film as much as I do to the other ones that we spoke about. I mean, I've seen the documentary. I know the story. I don't love Zemeckis as much as I used to. I feel the last great film that he made was What Lies Beneath. I liked Flight.
Me too.
But I thought that film had a lot of problems when it got into the third act and some of the second act. I mean, the first 45 minutes of that movie is just glorious. The opening shot of Denzel Washington just doing drugs and drinking in the hotel room with his stewardess or whatever, and then he just gets onto the plane. I mean, that whole scene where he saves the day,
it's incredible.
By piloting that plane is amazing.
Yeah, it's one of the best set pieces ever. That sequence is just that plane sequence is so thrillingly directed. It's not even funny.
Right. I just think it gets a little heavy-handed at the end, but that's just me. I'm a tough critic with stuff like that.
I really thoroughly enjoyed that one. I really liked the last scene. I felt like that movie set up a huge situation that played out pretty much as realistically as you could expect it to play out. I really enjoyed the decisions that character made at the end. But, you know, totally, I could see how it might not work for some people. I've been a fan of Zemeckis forever. I'm less of a fan of Zemeckis when he's doing the all CGI stuff.
Right.
Sort of got lost with all of that technology stuff that he got obsessed with. So when he got back to basics with something like Flight, I was really excited, and I thought he really nailed it. I'm a huge fan of Castaway and obviously the Back to the Future movies, Roger Rabbit. This to me looks like it could blend the kinds of things that he does so well, the technical and, you know, stuff with a heart. So we'll see. I'm a big fan of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I think that he's been consistently very interesting as an actor. He's picked some really good material over the last few years. So it's definitely on my list to see. And then the big new trailer for Mission Impossible 5, which on the face of it just sort of feels like more of the same. I don't know if that's how you feel about it. Not that it looks bad. It looks slick. It looks very, very well shot. It looks very intense with the action scenes, which you expect. But I just sort of, at this point, you know, how many movies have we seen where, you know, they're on the run from another group that's trying to close out IMF? You know, it sort of just seems like something we've seen before.
Yeah, it looks how it should look.
Exactly.
And I like the Mission Impossible films. The only ones I really love are the first one and the third one. I know you like the fourth one. I didn't care for the fourth one. The second one's cool for what it is, because it's a complete pivot from the original De Palma one. But, I mean...
Yeah, all four have had been very unique.
It's interesting. I love the first one because it's a spy movie. That's
yes.
What the first one essentially is. That's why I like it so much. The second one is definitely the
It was just John Woo doing his John Woo stuff in the prism of a Mission Impossible thing.
Right, but I think that really set the tone for the rest of the films, for them to want to up their game with more stunts and you know, more crazy stunts that Tom Cruise actually does. And I think that is what Mission Impossible prides himself on, is that, look, we're not using a stuntman for these crazy stunts. Tom Cruise is actually doing it himself. It's, like, cool. I like Tom Cruise a lot. You know, he has this little franchise going. They're going to make another Jack Reacher movie. I just miss the Tom Cruise from Magnolia and, you know, some of his meteor. Dramatic films, like, right, Collateral, and even Minority Report to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, he's had an interesting career. He's an interesting guy, to say the least. I mean, very interesting, to say the least. But, yeah, I just kind of miss the dramatic Tom Cruise, Born on the 4th of July, Rain Man, Firm, stuff like that, which, I mean, I'm sure he'll get back into.
Yeah, I mean,
one of these days.
Yeah, one of these days when he decides to stop being trying to be like a 30-year-old. Tom Cruise, it's very interesting. This year has been a very interesting year for me and Tom Cruise, because I have been such a fan for so long. I mean, in my opinion, he is one of just the greatest movie stars that there ever has been. I think that he is a very solid actor. He's been excellent any number of times. He's consistently been underrated for his talent as an actor. Because of the name and the brand and the, you know, the poster boy looks when he was younger, his whole thing has been completely taken down for me because of the documentary about Scientology that I watched this year. I lost so much respect for Tom Cruise. I haven't looked at him the same way since that documentary. Normally, I don't let what celebrities are doing in their private life affect my desire to see them in a movie. My whole feeling has sort of been, until they run someone over or get arrested for murder, or, you know, beating their wife or doing something crazy, then I'm gonna be there to watch their films because I enjoy their stuff. I couldn't believe the stuff in that documentary. It sickened me. He looks like a complete raving lunatic in the videos that they showed. He's complicit to basically slave driving. So I got really irritated watching that documentary. It soured me on the Tom Cruise brand, to be honest. So, and I agree with you. I think that right now he's skating completely. He's making movies with friends. He's not interested in making movies with Michael Mann or Oliver Stone or some of these other filmmakers that he had been making movies with, very interesting ones. He's working with Christopher McQuarrie repeatedly and, you
right.
know, going back to the well on franchise movies. And
I will say, to interject, I am looking forward to Top Gun 2.
Yeah, see, I have.
Come on.
For me, the Top Gun 2 jet completely flew off the aircraft carrier when Tony Scott passed away.
Yeah.
There really wasn't a need to make Top Gun 2 when Tony Scott was alive, unless they're able to get Ridley Scott or Michael Bay or somebody like that to do Top Gun 2. I don't know.
It might be dead in the water.
I honestly kind of hope that it is. I'm not sold on that. I was never sold on that movie when Tony was alive, and I'm not sold on it now when he's gone. And I just, like you said, I want another Magnolia. I'd rather see a Vanilla Sky. I'd rather see a Collateral.
Right.
I'd rather see him do something more unique and edgy and different. The movie that he's doing right now, I don't know the title. He's playing a drug runner for Doug Liman.
Mina? Yeah, I'm just looking it up on IMDb right now. Go ahead.
That one could be very cool. And I really did enjoy Edge of Tomorrow. I thought that was a lot of fun for a special effects movie. I thought the special effects in that movie were sensational. I don't know what you thought of that film.
I thought it was just repetitive, and I got it.
What was the whole point?
That was the whole point, but it was just...
I loved it.
I have a problem. I don't know, man. See, like, Edge of Tomorrow, Oblivion, Jack Reacher, all these movies, the Mission Impossible movies, I didn't see Night and Day, and I didn't see Rock of Ages.
The only one I haven't seen out of all those is Rock of Ages. Night and Day was very forgettable.
Old Boy's just totally coasting. And I mean, when I'm looking at his filmography right now, the last great things I think he's done was in 2007, 2008, when he was in Redford's Lions for Lambs, which I love, and I think that's incredibly underrated for as big of a propaganda movie as that is. I think that was the last great dramatic performance that Tom Cruise gave. And, I mean, that's coming up on 10 years old. And then, obviously, 2008, he did Tropic Thunder, which is probably one of the most outrageous roles I've ever seen an actor play in their entire career.
Yeah, Tropic Thunder is a masterpiece in every respect for me. It's one of the funniest modern comedies. The performances on the part of everybody in that movie are tour de force level. I mean... The Les Grossman character is one of the most disgusting takedowns of Hollywood that's ever been put forth. I loved it. And I just, you know, it goes without saying, Robert Downey Jr. in that movie is a pisser. And Jack Black, who I'm 50-50 on, he is amazing in that film. The first 25 minutes of Tropic Thunder, where they're doing the character introductions and getting to know everybody, it's some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen in a movie.
Right. I love it. Yeah, they're supposed to do a Les Grossman movie, but that is, I don't know what's going on with that one.
Yeah, it was talked about for a while, and you know, I think that they kind of realized that, you know, I don't really know if a whole movie built around that character is doable or how that would be done, but you know, they'll figure out everything in Hollywood if they think they can make a dollar on it. So
right.
But yeah, I really wish the Scientology thing would just go away, but it's not, and I really wish that he would get back to making some of the grittier, more interesting movies, more personal. I loved him in Collateral. Like, I would love to see him play a bad guy again. I mean, he was so good in that film, and cutting.
Collateral, Magnolia. Magnolia is, I think that's his best performance. I mean, you got Magnolia, Born on the 4th of July, A Few Good Men, Rain Man, The Color of Money.
The
Color of Money he is just brilliant in.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's
before
he... That was kind of at the, you know, the birth of Tom Cruise, when he became who he is. And, you know, I know what you're saying with the Scientology stuff, and I've seen the documentary. I love the documentary. It's really scary shit. I mean, it's frightening stuff, and I really love The Master even more after watching that documentary. But I do my best to differentiate people from however they are off screen. And a good example for me is Clint Eastwood. And when Clint Eastwood gave the address at the Republican National Convention last cycle, it was one of the most, it was just a complete calamity. I don't know if you ever saw it or if you watched the video on YouTube of Clint Eastwood's address in prime time, but I mean, it was just this terrible ramble, and, I mean, whatever. I,
Yeah, I try my hardest, but for this one, I just was really, really, really soured on it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It just was really upsetting, and like, I just don't understand, you know, I do understand, but I guess I don't want to understand how people could allow themselves to get duped. And it's sad, but in any event, that's not my problem. That's his. let's get into our
take that, Tom Cruise.
Take that, Tom. But let's get into our movie, which Tom Cruise might have been cast in had this movie been made 15 years ago. He could have played the Michael Fassbender role, probably. You know, if you think about it.
I think you might have actually spoiled the chance of Tom Cruise ever coming on our podcast.
I probably did.
So you know. So when that day comes,
then
I'm not gonna be happy.
You can hold me responsible.
Mm-hmm.
But Ridley Scott's The Counselor. Let's get into it. I know that this is an incredibly hated film on a critical level. Critics destroyed this movie in 2013 when it was released. Fox really paid no attention to it. They put all of their eggs in their basket with 12 Years a Slave during a wartime. They brought this movie out in October, released it fairly wide-ish, hid the film from press until a couple of days before the release, which is never a good sign for anybody, which also gets critics. They start sharpening their knives anytime a movie is withheld from them, for a few weeks before it's going to come out. It's an incredibly nasty film, so I guess I'm not surprised by the level of hate that was levied at it by some critics. The cinema score was a D or a D minus. That's the, you know, the aggregate rating that they take on opening weekend throughout the country, people's initial response to the film. People hated this film overall. And in retrospect, I'm not surprised that a lot of people have such a strong, strong disliking for it, because it really is a walk on the dark and wild side, which isn't for everybody. But the thing that really disappoints me is that, with the exception of a few very, very well-written reviews from some sharp critics who really were interested in delving into what this movie is talking about, the job of a film critic is supposed to be objectively looking at a piece of art as for the meaning, for the intent, for the style, for the presentation. And to read the reviews that some of these people were paid to write, it makes me so upset and it makes me so annoyed that they're the ones getting the chance to quote-unquote be the voice of cinema in their city or state, and they took down a film that deserved to be embraced by the critical community, that it was important for this movie to be embraced by the critical community, so that it would have had a better chance at finding people at the box office. People complain that every single movie is, you know, marvelized, and there's nothing new, and there's nothing original, and there's nothing exciting for adults. Well, this was that movie. And again, we're going to talk about what it's about in a minute, but I just want to sort of open up the piece with my, you know, my overall comment that people really miss the point on this film. And I know that you had not seen it in the theater, but you had purchased the Blu-ray and had it, and you waited until this week to watch it, and you fell in love with it.
Yeah, I think it's a masterpiece. And I think that this movie achieves what it sets out to achieve with hopelessness and bleakness, and Well, here's the thing.
Just out of curiosity, because you are a Ridley Scott fan overall, from what I can gather, you've liked a lot of his movies, and you do see a lot of films. Was there a reason that you didn't see this film in the theater? Was there something that held you back from going to see it when it was out? Or
I'm not too sure. I can't really remember. Because this came out when I was living with my buddy Peyton, and we go see movies all the time together. And I remember seeing the teaser for this and being like, dude, it's written by Cormac McCarthy, it's directed by Ridley Scott, and it has the greatest cast we've ever seen together. You know, I don't know why we didn't go see it in theaters. I think we meant to, and then it just disappeared so fast.
Yeah, it was out for 3 weeks in Connecticut, so I can't imagine that it was out for any longer than a month in Chicago. So
right, and then
so the reviews the reviews meant nothing to you personally. Were you even aware?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
you saw that it was getting pummeled, that was getting piled on. Yep.
Right, and I mean, let's be frank about this. I mean, it's written by Cormac McCarthy, and
so what would you expect exactly? Like, what would
exactly?
Like,
I mean,
what were people expecting?
Well, I think a lot of people probably don't know who Cormac McCarthy actually is. I think that might have a lot to do with it. I think that you look at all of his work that has been made into a film the past few years, No Country for Old Men, The Road, Sunset Limited. I mean, none of those movies instill hope. And I guess if you could argue that any of them do, it would be The Road, mm-hmm. due to the ending. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you've seen that, right?
The Road, for me, was the best movie of its year. I've watched it probably 10 times. I think that it
right.
is, I think it's incredible.
And I mean, at the end of the film, all is lost. I mean, you know that there's no hope, mm-hmm. and then there is. There's that glimmer of hope, but in the reality of things, you know what the outcome is going to be.
Exactly.
I mean, that's Cormac McCarthy's style, and a lot of the reviews that I've read this past week. All of these guys that are film critics, that are major critics, are smart people. And they know exactly what this film's trying to say. And
they just don't want to hear it.
Right, and they just don't want it. Because, I mean, honestly, you know, No Country for Old Men's a different beast in a way, because it's the Coen brothers. And I think the Coen brothers get a lot more respect than somebody even like Ridley Scott does. I think the Coen brothers are kind of set on this tier by critics and people. And I mean, rightfully so, because they're brilliant. But as much as I love No Country for Old Men, I think that this film's better. And I think
I think it's more challenging, yeah.
Yeah,
not that No Country isn't.
No, yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, here's the thing with No Country. I think the critics loved it. The Academy obviously loved it. I think a lot of people who saw it didn't understand it, or they got hung up with the ending. I think that is what Cormac McCarthy's strongest suit is, with how he ties everything up. I think the ending for No Country for Old Men, for probably the average filmgoer, it just ends.
Yes.
But it doesn't.
It was extraordinarily frustrating for a lot of people, the ending of that movie.
Right, and I think a lot of people kind of miss the fact that Tommy Lee Jones is the main character, and the whole film's about him and his interpretation of the world. But, I mean, we can talk about that at a later time, because I'm sure somewhere down the road we're going to discuss No Country for Old Men. But as far as being challenging, I think this is one of the most challenging films I've ever seen. And as far as McCarthy's works go, I think probably Sunset Limited is the most challenging, but Sunset Limited is an acquired taste. That's not a film that, you know, a studio is going to get behind. That was an HBO movie done by Tommy Lee Jones, who's friends with Cormac McCarthy. That's not for everybody. It's interesting to me that the studio would put out The Counselor.
The only thing about it that smells of studio is the star
right.
power, but it is without a doubt the most uncompromising, bleakest studio movie that has come out in forever long. The moment that I saw it, I likened it to a modern day, you know, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, you know, Sam Peckinpah.
Right.
Great film. And that was a movie that had a sense of nihilism and a sense of hopelessness that I thought that The Counselor really, really trafficked in. So just for people who aren't familiar with The Counselor, The Counselor is a movie about a lawyer who is only referred to by the name Counselor throughout the entire film, Michael Fassbender. And he's a guy that on the face of it seems to have everything. He looks great. He's got the clothes. He's got the car. He's got Penelope Cruz as his new fiance. He's got everything, but as always, he wants more. Everybody wants more in this film. This movie is a study of greed. It's a study of excess. It's a study of new money. And he, what I love about this film is that the plot of this movie, which is oblique, and you do really have to sort of follow it in a very close fashion. The plot of this movie is already in high gear when this film starts. A couple of things have occurred off screen that have set up the events that make up the plot of this movie before scene one is even unfolded. Michael Fassbender is drawn into drug world. He's going to facilitate money transfer, handoff. He's going to be involved in a big drug deal. Drugs are being transported throughout the Mexican border with what state is it in? I can never remember exactly where the movie takes place in.
New Mexico?
Yeah, New Mexico.
No. It takes place in Texas.
Texas.
Because that's where all McCarthy stuff essentially takes place.
Yeah, takes place in Texas, and he's drawn into this world of crime, drugs, led by three very important people. Brad Pitt, who plays this sort of rogue cowboy middleman who is sort of facilitating the deal that Michael Fassbender is involved in with the crime organization. Javier Bardem is a restaurateur, just sort of a playboy, flashy guy that's involved with this snake of a woman played by Cameron Diaz, who is, you know, in classic femme fatale form, may or may not know more than she lets on. And what you basically have is four movie stars who we've gotten to know throughout the years in a variety of performances, especially Fassbender over the last few years, because he seems like he's just been on a complete tear as an actor. You have these great, good-looking, very exciting actors really shredding their images completely. I mean, Cameron Diaz hasn't even come close to playing something like this in her entire career. I think this movie just set her. This, to me, is just the greatest thing she's ever done by far. Taking a chance that she's never taken before as an actress. Brad Pitt could have played the Michael Fassbender role 10, 15 years ago. Now he's getting to play these sleazy, these great off-kilter guys in movies like this and in Killing Them Softly. And then you get Javier Bardem, who's cut such a convincing portrait of a psychopath in No Country for Old Men, which is a nice little sort of call out between, you know, McCarthy movies, McCarthy projects. You get him sort of subverting his menacing, in control psychopath that he's done a couple of times now. And he's this sort of loose cannon guy that doesn't have grasp on the situation as well. The thing that this movie sort of revolves around is how all of these people think that they have their world and their orbit intact, and they truly feel that they are the masters of their own domain, if you will, when in reality there are things that are happening that are beyond their forces and beyond their control, and they just, you know, they just don't see it coming at any point.
Right, but those unforeseen forces are all brought onto them by decisions and choices they have made.
Exactly. Hence the wonderful tagline that we've been throwing back and forth all week, Sin is a Choice. So
Sin is a Choice, exactly.
And it's just one of those movies that it really wants to look and get under the surface, the good-looking surface of money and of success and excess. And I think that the reason why some people were really put off by it, it's because who doesn't want to be successful? Who doesn't want to have the nice car or have enough money to be able to do whatever they want and and be able to fly to Amsterdam to buy the woman that you love the right diamond. In that wonderful scene that goes down between Fassbender and Bruno Ganz in the beginning, when he's going to go buy the diamond, and Bruno Ganz calls it a cautionary stone. The movie is a cautionary, tale for our current desire to always be satiated, and who wants to sort of have their hands slapped when they want to have a good time? And this movie does a lot more than hand slapping to its characters. This is an incredibly violent film at times, unrelentingly, uncompromisingly violent, especially for a studio film. The extended director's cut has even more in the way of bloodletting than the theatrical cut. And it's a movie that just doesn't seem, it feels like a 70, like one of those movies that would have been made in the 70s and nowadays feels like it escaped. It feels like they made it at night when no one was watching. And because Ridley Scott's name was on it, for whatever reason, people from the studio never interjected. I can't believe this movie got made at a studio level, that executives read it, money people read it, were cool with it, that went along with the ending. It's just a remarkable achievement that this movie got made at all.
Well, right, and I mean, I agree with everything you just said, and the reason it did get made was, okay, Cormac McCarthy wrote No Country for Old Men. The Academy loved that. He's going to write us his first original screenplay that isn't based on his book. And by the way, he has never written an adaptation of one of his books for the screen. So this is Cormac McCarthy writing something specifically for the screen that is completely original. We're going to get Ridley Scott to come in and direct it. Everybody loves Ridley Scott. The guy made Gladiator. The guy made Blade Runner. He made Matchstick Men. I mean, essentially, Ridley Scott's never made a bad movie. We're going to get Fassbender. We're going to get Pitt. We're going to get Javier Bardem. We're going to get Cameron Diaz. We're going to get Penelope Cruz. We're going to get an A-list cast that is going to draw in so much money. It's going to be insane. And it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because this film has balls. And I mean, Jesus Christ, man. I don't even know where to begin with this, talking about this film. I watched it for the first time, and in the opening scene, the scene between Penelope Cruz and Michael Fassbender, and they're laying in his bed, and Michael Fassbender is, corrupting Penelope Cruz, who's this sweet, good-natured, innocent woman. I sent you a message, and I said, Michael Fassbender is my hero in this. I want to be Michael Fassbender. The funny thing is, by the end of the movie, I do not want to be Michael Fassbender. I do not want to be anywhere near Michael Fassbender in this film. What drew me to this instantly was the dialogue. The dialogue is fierce, and it punches you. And there is no word or contraction or punctuation that does not have significant meaning. And I watched the film. I watched the film again. I watched the film a third time. I went to Barnes & Noble. I bought the screenplay. I read it. I read the screenplay again. I watched the unrated director's cut. This film is unlike anything I've ever seen before, and it felt completely new to me while I was watching it. I mean, sure, I'm familiar with Cormac McCarthy. I love Cormac McCarthy. I'm familiar with the characters that we see. Brad Pitt playing the greasy cowboy, Javier Bardem playing the flamboyant, flashy drug kingpin / businessman, Cameron Diaz playing the femme fatale, Penelope Cruz playing the innocent flower that's corrupted. What was completely new to me in the film was the script and the dialogue. The scenes with Javier Bardem, and I think this is Bardem's finest performance. There is so much truth in this screenplay and the way things are laid out. I mean, Javier Bardem's character is completely interesting in the film because, you know, we are used to seeing Bardem, No Country for Old Men, Skyfall, the psychopath that is completely unhinged and is flamboyant. He might not be as flamboyant in No Country for Old Men, but he definitely has his own presence and memorable presence. I mean, Skyfall, Bardem is out of control, and he's zany, and he is flamboyant. And Bardem is the same in The Counselor, but what's interesting about this film is this is a film about bad people. I mean,
bad people making bad decisions, which typically a lot of audiences don't really want to see. They don't want to be reminded of the bad decisions that people can make, especially when movie stars are making them.
Right, and I think what sets this apart from just bad decisions is this film isn't black and white. You know, this film would be interesting if there was a black and white version of it. Because when I got done watching this for the first time, this film is completely, you know, presented in extreme shades of gray. And, you know, Fassbender's interesting because he is this person who has everything under control in his life. He's done everything right in his life. He's educated. He is in great physical shape. He has a very good job. He has a very nice house. He drives a Bentley. He is engaged to the perfect woman, but that's not enough. And he has to invest in this drug deal. And it's interesting Bardem's take in the film because Bardem is essentially the only cautionary character in the film. He explains things to the counselor about how there's no going back. There is moral dilemmas that you're going to have to face if you cross this road. And when I came to you 2 years ago about it, you didn't want to do it, but now you want to do it. And it's interesting because Brad Pitt's character, Westray, which I love, and I love that name, he's cautionary in a way, too, but he doesn't really give a fuck.
He's just way too cocky for his own good, which I love.
He is, and I think Javier Bardem is... Well, it's interesting. Javier Bardem and the counselor are obviously friends, and they've known each other for quite some time, which is... That's what I love about this film. This film doesn't tell you anything.
No.
But it shows you. It shows you enough, and you start to put pics... You can piece it together. You know that Javier Bardem and Brad Pitt are friends, but they share no screen time. All these characters know about each other, but it's very rare that they'll actually share screen time. The counselor is the only character that kind of moves in and out of everybody's bubble throughout the film, and pieces get put together that way. You know, and the fact that Penelope Cruz and Cameron Diaz share scenes together, it's like, well, how do they even know one another, and how would they even exist in the same world? And it's because of the counselor. And you can't help but take from the fact that, like you said, this film has already started before the opening shot is even shown. So you know that the counselor and Penelope Cruz and Bardem and Cameron Diaz have all been together or partied together,
yep,
gone out to dinner. Right, exactly. It's fascinating. And to go back to the script...
And it's so different for Ridley Scott, which is what I'll get to in a little bit. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And to get back to the script, what's interesting to me is how there is so much foreshadowing in this film. It's ridiculous with things that are brought up, you know, lines of dialogue that are inconsequential at the time. There's a lot of foreshadowing with the counselor and Penelope Cruz and a lot of stuff that's said that plays a, you know, a pivotal, devastating role later on in the film. Early on in the film, you're introduced to Javier Bardem asking the counselor, do you know what a bolito is? And the counselor says, no, a, a bolido is like a skinny necktie or, you know, a lasso or something. It's interesting, and right away you know that that's going to play an important part in the film. And I got all chubbed up in that scene when Javier Bardem's asking him about the bolido, because you know that's going to show up. And when it does, it's absolutely perfect. But man, the dialogue and the script, I mean, where are you ever going to see a movie where, aside from the meaty dialogue between characters like the Counselor and Javier Bardem's Rainer or Brad Pitt's Westray and the Counselor, what other film or script is going to have the same meaty dialogue where the Counselor is talking to the diamond dealer, Bruno Ganz, early on in the film? Or when, when this film comes to its climax of what happens to the Counselor's character and what the ramifications are of his actions, or his actions that he didn't even do, but he's held accountable for because of a choice he made.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about this movie. It's not even that he did anything wrong except for just being there and wanting to be in the room with these people.
Exactly. He didn't, you know, yeah, he invested in a drug deal. Whatever. But the ramifications that he gets, it's insane. And, you know, this doesn't spoil anything.
Rosie Perez, but, just like...
Yeah, and I mean, okay, here, I'll throw that out. The character actors that are littered throughout this film, I mean, you get Rosie Perez in a brief scene, and then one more, you know, 10-second scene. I don't like Rosie Perez, but she's awesome in this. I mean, you get Bruno Ganz as the diamond dealer. You get Dean Norris from Breaking Bad and John Leguizamo and all sorts of...
And Ruben
great
Blades.
Character actors. I'm getting to Ruben Blades, baby.
Yeah.
I mean, when I knew that this movie was great, and I'm talking 10 out of 10, 5 stars out of 4 stars. I mean, when I knew this film was great was at the end of towards the end of the film when the Counselor is just at the bottom, as rock bottom as he can get, trying to figure out what happened and how he can fix things. He talks to Ruben Blades on the phone, who is a cartel, the head of a cartel. Essentially what happens is the drug deal that is going on in the film gets jacked. And no one knows who did it, but everybody's looking at the Counselor because he's the new guy that they've got that came in on this deal. But I mean, Ruben Blades owns this film. He owns this film like William Hurt owns A History of Violence. And I mean, I was just taken aback so hard by the Ruben Blades dialogue to the Counselor. I mean, holy God. As much as Ridley Scott's visual style is amazing, and the plethora of amazing actors that is littered throughout this entire film, the entire backbone is McCarthy's screenplay and how philosophical this guy writes. One line of dialogue that I absolutely love is the second meeting between Brad Pitt and Fassbender's The Counselor, and it's when something bad happened. It's essentially when the film turns and the shipment gets jacked. You know, they meet in a hotel restaurant, and the Counselor knows he's fucked. Brad Pitt knows the Counselor's fucked, and Brad Pitt plays it in an interesting way. And I love the line of dialogue where Brad Pitt asks, "Do you know who the Green Hornet is?" And Fassbender is just distraught, and he has no idea how he's going to fix this problem that shouldn't even be his problem in the first place, but he got dragged into it. Brad Pitt, do you know who the Green Hornet is? And in the midst of the Counselor being dumbfounded by the whole situation, he just looks up at him and he says, "He's a cartoon character." And it's just simple stuff like that. But I mean, here you say. Jump in here, because I mean, I could gush.
I think there's so many levels to this movie that are exciting and thoughtful and different. For me, one of the biggest things about this movie is that it just reaffirms that when Ridley Scott isn't necessarily interested in telling another epic movie, which he does great, there's really few directors that know how to do the big, epic, historical sword and sandal and sand movie that he's been, you know, associated with for so long. But when he gets small and when he gets intimate and when he gets very character-based, the films, in my opinion, are as good, if not better, than his really epic stuff. I mean, two of the movies that other than The Counselor, Matchstick Men really sticks out for me as yet another indication of a movie that was not hated by critics, but underrated to a certain degree. There were people that loved it. But it was a movie that didn't do, I think it made like $40 million in the theaters. It wasn't a huge hit. It was outside of what you expect from Ridley Scott. And that's what made this movie so exciting, that he's known for his visual style, for always being a painter with light and with the camera. And in this movie, you do get very exacting visual compositions. Darius Wolski's cinematography sort of subverts the beauty of all of the people and the imagery around you, all of the scene, the locales, and all of the really, really nice stuff that's in every shot. He gives it sort of this sad, dispassionate, sort of this like sickly sheen that is carried over into the themes that the movie's exploring. And he kind of got out, like you said, this movie is predicated on the characters and on the script first and foremost. And Ridley Scott got out of his own way to a certain degree. Not that he's ever been an aesthetically ostentatious filmmaker like Tony Scott was. Ridley has never been interested in pushing the form of the visual image in the way that his brother was. He's been more of a classicist with his imagery, very beautiful, very studied. Here, there is a very distinct sort of formal precision that you would associate more with the Coen brothers, I think, especially in No Country for Old Men, where every shot in that film feels perfect and in great sync with the shot before it and then the shot after. It's just such a unique film for Ridley Scott, because people typically respond to him typically when he goes for the big and when he goes for the epic, and not so much with the small. And that must be something. And that must be something that he knows in the back of his head. I mean, you can't not, you know, you can't ignore, you know, you can't. When you look at the results, the box office results, or the reception for his movies, when he goes big, typically people come out and see it. If it's a sci-fi movie or a movie like Robin Hood or a movie like Gladiator, you know, Kingdom of Heaven didn't do very well here, but it was a huge hit overseas. You know, those are the kinds of things I think people know him for. Some people online, you know, have made comments that they felt that The Counselor was more of a Tony Scott movie than a Ridley Scott movie, and I couldn't disagree any more than, I couldn't disagree.
Yeah, no,
I think it is.
There's no way.
Yeah, there's nothing like a Tony Scott movie. Tony Scott's movies always had a lot of heart. There was a lot of emotion. Not that there's not a lot of heart or emotion in The Counselor. They're just really black and evil, and I don't think that Tony had the cynicism in him to make a film like The Counselor. And it also should be noted that this movie was happening. It started before Tony died, but this is the movie that was being shot when Ridley Scott found out that his brother committed suicide.
What a film to make.
Yeah, so
finding out that your brother killed himself.
So you start the film with your brother alive, and I think a quarter of the way through production, he, you know, his own life, and they shut production down for a week or whatever, and then they get back into it. And my assumption is that the tough place that he may have been in as a person sort of fueled the fire to really make that movie as fierce as it was. I'm just assuming here. I mean, you had the nastiness on the page to begin with, but I can't help but feel that psychologically, that the death of Tony may have had some sort of, you know, unforeseen or subliminal impact on the overall package that movie is. It's just a startling film on every level, from the way that it opens when they're in bed, to with the graphic dialogue. You don't normally hear that kind of talk coming out of people, especially big movie stars. And to the way that the information is doled out, Ridley Scott has been throughout his career, he's been a very A to B to C kind of guy. And this movie is not A to B to C in any stretch. This is a movie that, you know, like we said, when the film starts, things have occurred that you need to sort of pick up on your own. You need to make leaps of logic and leaps of connectivity on your own without being force-fed exposition. That's the one thing that this movie is so wonderful, is that if there isn't any exposition in this movie, it's exposition that is told in a sort of poetic manner. So even when you have somebody explaining something to you, you're still sort of like, interesting. There's nothing simple about this movie, and there's very little about it that feels familiar. Whereas when we're talking about you can't compare a movie like The Counselor to something like a franchise film. But these are the kinds of movies that I'm really anxious to see, where people are going to stretch themselves as a filmmaker. Like, I would love to see Steven Spielberg make a film that's as vicious as this. You know, like, he's capable of it. He showed everybody how to make a modern war film with Saving Private Ryan. He put the knife in the head in Munich. When he wants to have a pair of balls, he will. I'd love to see him make a pared down, very intense adult thriller, the way that Ridley Scott sort of stepped up and changed his game up with this. And now Ridley Scott's, of course, getting into the, right after the Counselor, what does he do? He retreats back to the world of Sword and Sandals and Exodus, and nobody went out and saw that film. So, which was interesting, because I kind of figured that was going to be a huge hit, and that didn't perform well at all at the box office. So it's going to be interesting to see where he goes from here, because the last couple movies have been failures, both critically and commercially. He's now going to get into, I think, producing. He's going to be producing the Blade Runner sequel.
Right. He's going to do The Martian, which will be a sci-fi epic.
Yeah, and coming up this year, we've got The Martian, which I'm very excited for. So.
And then he's going to go right from that into Prometheus 2, is what he's going to do, and it'll reunite him with Fassbender.
So is he's going to direct it?
Yeah, he made the choice between Prometheus 2 or Blade Runner 2, whatever one he was going to do, and he chose to do Prometheus 2. I mean, I'm happy either way. I think the director that they brought on for Prometheus 2 is perfect, or I should say Blade Runner 2 is perfect. Casting Gosling, if that holds true, and getting Harrison Ford back is perfect. What makes The Counselor so great and so fascinating is you don't see Ridley Scott's fingerprints on it.
No.
You don't see Brad Pitt as Brad Pitt. You don't see Bardem as Bardem. You know, the film is completely new and completely fresh, which is amazing, because you don't see movies like this. Movies like this rarely get made. I can't think of another film like The Counselor that I saw where I just thought to myself, oh my God. You know, maybe Closer, Mike Nichols' film with Jude Law, Clive Owen, Natalie Portman, and Julia Roberts comes close to the ferocity of The Counselor being made by A-listers. But then again, that movie was an Academy darling in a way. I mean, the critics loved it. It won awards, Golden Globes and such. But, you know, what you talk about with how nothing, you know, there's so much form and void with The Counselor, and there's so much stuff that had happened off screen and continues to happen on screen that you don't see, and you're shown fragments of it, and you have to put pieces together. What I really love about this film is the only scenes that don't revolve around any of the main characters is of that septic tanker truck that is driving from Mexico to Chicago, that has none of the main characters in any of the scenes. And throughout the film, there's just cut-ins of that truck driving down the road, and I love what that's saying. You know, essentially what that's saying is you can't stop what's coming. And how true is that to any of the characters in the film? I mean, there's one character that has control over everything. I mean, there's one character that has a master plan that's in control of their world. Everybody else spirals out of control. And they can't, I mean, that's what I, got it. And that's a line from No Country for Old Men. You can't stop what's coming. And that's exactly what the counselor is. I mean, that truck has started and it has its destination. And when it reaches that destination, there's going to be hell to pay from everyone. And it's just, it's tough. It's just, it's incredibly tough. And I've never seen anything quite like this film. And I'm completely enamored and obsessed with it right now. I can't get enough of it. I mean, I know when I told you I watched it, you asked me which cut I watched, and I watched the theatrical cut probably 4 times, and then I read the screenplay twice, and then after reading the screenplay is when I watched the unrated Blu-ray, which, by the way, took me a while to figure out how to watch it because apparently the counselor came with 2 discs. One of each cut of the film, and you know those inserts they put inside of Blu-rays. Like I didn't see the other one was the unrated director's cut because there's like that voodoo digital code or whatever. But anyway, yeah, you know, and watching the director's cut was cool for me because it just added a bunch of dialogue that I read in the screenplay that I didn't see in the film, and I enjoyed it. Plus, it's a little more graphic with the Bolito scene. Well, it's a lot more graphic with the Bolito scene. But, yeah, man, this is one of those rare moments in cinema where there's no way this film could get made. Essentially, everything, I think, kind of lined up perfectly. And, you know, with Ridley Scott attaching himself to it, with the A-list cast attaching themselves to the film, you're right when you say that this film could not be made now by a studio. There's no way a studio would make this. This would be a Mark Pellington VOD movie. With, you know, there's no way. There's no way this would get made now.
Yeah, it feels very specific. It feels especially in context with what saturates the market every weekend. It feels very uncommon, and given that the reaction was so hostile, I think that it'll be, you know, unless you have a filmmaker with the pedigree of Ridley Scott's name, I think it'll be a long time before we get something this overtly nasty and this, you know, this totally uncompromising inside of the studio realm. If you want to talk about movies that offer up bleak, uncompromising views of the world and, you know, incredible situations, I could give you a list of, you know, 10 movies off, you know, right off the top of my head, but none of them are from this country and none of them, you know, are made in any sort of, you know, realm of a studio situation. So it's truly one of those movies that got away, as they would say. And I can sort of say that the performances of the film and how they all tie into each other and how everybody is just so, with the exception of one character, everyone is so unlikable without really offering any small way in to empathize, because they're all just so desperate and so greedy and so messed up. And for me, that's always going to be richer than a goody two shoes who has everything together. And, you know, what's fun in that? But it's just a shame that more people weren't interested in taking a chance on something this dangerous. And, you know, this movie kind of makes you feel like an outlaw when you're watching it. You feel dangerous because these people are in a dangerous situation. And that's for me, that's a cool feeling when you're watching a film.
Right. You know, I said this earlier, but this film is so philosophical, and there hasn't been many films that come to mind that I've watched where the words in the film can the words in the film, the dialogue in the film can teach you things about yourself or have you look at things in an interesting way. Because I watched this film, I have, you know, I can't relate to anything that I've seen on this screen. This is a world that I've never seen, and more than likely in my life, and I hope not, that I would ever be involved in. The choices that are made and the decisions that are made, but the lines of dialogue are so prominent with being able to identify with these characters. I mean, holy cow, Javier Bardem particularly, you know, probably upon my second or third watch, I really started to understand the character and understand that character's fears and what's driving him. And then, Ruben Blades, I can't say enough about his performance and the scene he has. I mean, it's just so fierce. It's just so fiercely written. I love it. I mean,
yeah, the movie comes,
there's so
the movie
many quotable lines.
The movie comes to a halt in a good way when he shows up and he just absolutely kills that scene. It's one of the most florally written things. Like, it's just so poetic, and there was almost like a Mamet touch to some of the dialogue in this movie. I know that it obviously was Cormac McCarthy and it rings true to his prose completely. From just the few books, I haven't read all of his books, but from the few that I've read, it feels very, very much in his world. But there was almost this David Mamet style to some of this, I felt, at times. I think right now would probably be a good time to get into our top fives because, you know, considering that both of them are related to The Counselor, you want to start with your top five for Brad Pitt?
Yeah, I will segue into my top five for Brad Pitt. Interestingly enough, I got slammed down pretty hard on my top five for Bridges when I posted it from other people. It's just, man, top five lists are so difficult to nail down. And I mean, essentially what it comes down to is personal preference. But anyway,
and I had to
unapologetic.
Do that again. Yeah.
Unapologetically is my top five performances for Brad Pitt. My number five is Babel. I absolutely love that film, and I think that was the first film where Brad Pitt genuinely transitioned from movie star to actor. And I loved his performance in it. It was so heartbreaking. And he also kind of, that's also where he transitioned into not necessarily being the center focus of the film and not needing to be on the screen, you know, 90% of the time. I think Brad Pitt's an actor's actor, and I think his filmography as of late is a perfect representation of Brad Pitt picking films that he believes in, not films where he's going to make a lot of money and his face is going to be all over everything. So Babel's my number five. My number four is Seven. Tough film. It's, you know, Seven's a masterpiece made by a master filmmaker. My number three is going to be The Tree of Life. I think Tree of Life is another example of Brad Pitt lending his name and face to a film that he believes in. That I'm sure was a tough film to get off of the ground when it was pitched, especially being made by the reclusive Terrence Malick. I think Brad Pitt's frightening in that film, and he doesn't get a lot of notoriety for that performance, which I think he should. I think that film is one of the best films I've ever seen in my entire life and one of the most moving films I've ever seen. My number two for Brad Pitt is going to be 12 Monkeys, one of the most unhinged and crazy performances I've ever seen. Absolutely love that film. Absolutely love Pitt in it. I think he's just insane in that movie and in a good way. And then my number one is a tie between Killing Them Softly and The Counselor. And I think that I think those two performances go hand in hand. And I think they're the benchmark of when Pitt became a great actor. He'd always been a great actor, but these two performances really seal it for me, where I'm excited for anything that he's going to be in and anything that he's going to attach his name in the future. They're not necessarily the most glamorous roles, but he brings just this brevity and gravitas to them that is paramount. And it's just, they're so good. He's so good in both of the films. I mean, Jesus. I just never grow tired of his performances in Killing Them Softly and The Counselor. Not like I have in any of his other films, but I mean, great. All right, so that's my top five. What are yours?
I'm going to preface this with, this was easily the hardest top five I've had to make personally for any of the podcasting Them Softly episodes we've done. Brad Pitt's been one of my favorite actors ever since 1994-95 when he busted out with Legends of the Fall and with Seven. It's just, if there's been one actor who really throughout the last whatever 20 years, whatever it's been, who really just every movie that he's made, I want to see, it's been Brad Pitt. So I have cheated all over this top five. My number five is a tie between The Counselor and Killing Them Softly. I loved his extended cameos, you know, more or less in these movies, you know, movies that weren't built around him as the star. But now that he can do whatever the hell he wants, he's more than happy to sort of sit back and play the scene stealer and, you know, subvert the pretty boy image and, you know, get down and dirty. So those two performances feel like spiritual cousins. And for me, those would be my tie for number five. Number four is his relatively brief role in Tony Scott's True Romance as the
Floyd.
Floyd, the honey bear bong smoking roommate to Michael Rapaport, who so memorably offers the mafioso goon who's wielding the double barrel shotgun if he wants to smoke bull, which is met with the cocking of the shotgun in rather memorable fashion. Loved him in that movie. It's a very whatever performance, but it would be the first of a couple of workings that he had with Tony Scott. He would reteam with him on Spy Game later on in his career. And I just love True Romance in general, and I just love Brad Pitt in that movie. I just find him to be so funny. Number three is his performance in Bennett Miller's Moneyball, which I think is just one of the great sports movies, and he gave such a tender, emotional, awesome performance as Billy Bean. I loved the stuff between him and his daughter. It really got to me. I love the interaction that he had with everybody in that film, from the sequences with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's playing Art Howe, to all of the scenes in the scouting room with all of those real scouts that they, you know, brought in for the movie. You've seen Moneyball, right?
I have.
Yeah. Were you a fan?
I liked it. I didn't love it.
Oh,
I do own it on Blu-ray, though.
Yeah, I saw that twice in the theater. I've watched it four or five times. I loved his interaction with Jonah Hill. I thought that Jonah Hill to me is like this guy that, you know, like, let's put him with Brad Pitt. Doesn't seem like a great combination, but we'll see what happens. It's fucking awesome. Let's put him with Leonardo DiCaprio. It's like not the thing you'd normally think. Fucking awesome. You know, I think Jonah Hill's great, and I love how he's been able to bounce off some of these great actors in these dramatic roles. But for me, Moneyball is just a smooth, really, really well-executed film, and I love Brad Pitt in that movie. I love how he's eating in a lot of the scenes. He loves to eat in movies. It's always been a thing. The Oceans movies, he's eating in almost every scene, which I've always loved. But I just loved how he was wearing like a sweatsuit outfit and lifting weights and, you know, just like being all cool and being Brad Pitt in that movie, and I really enjoyed it. Number two for me is Seven. The original gut punch movie for me from my youth. I saw that movie in the theater when I was 15. Just completely blew me away. Brad Pitt was just amazing in it. I almost went with a tie between 7 and Fight Club just because I love Fight Club so much. But 7 for me just edges it because there's just something so, so intense about 7 and especially the ending, which I just love. And it's just heartbreaking every time you see it. And my number one is just a complete cheat. Whatever, I don't care. You can sue me. I'm going with a three-way tie between...
Jesus.
I had to, and I think you'll understand why. I'm going with a three-way tie between the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, the Tree of Life, and the Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And this is why. I personally think that those three movies and those three performances are all sort of interlinked. They are very, very, very internal performances with a few moments of explosive anger or rage or emotion, but they sort of represented to me all three of those performances represent to me Brad Pitt's ability to convey stuff with his face, to convey stuff with mood, with posture, especially in Tree of Life and in Jesse James. As you said, he is the frightening father figure that, you know, everybody had or heard about or knew about or saw one time. And the way that he walks in that film conveys so much, sort of in the way he sits in that rocking chair in Jesse James with the rattlesnakes wrapped around his arms, and he's just thinking about stuff. That movie's about people thinking. And when you think about Benjamin Button and how that's a film about a man allowing the world to come to him and how he experiences things, I've just always felt that those three performances were quiet and internalized and reserved, and they sort of all live in the same field of existence. So that's my rationale for cheating.
I can abide by that. I think that's excellent. Yeah, man. I mean, these top five lists are fun. They're just so hard to make because you have to
go with your gut and what you love. And honestly, this is to say nothing of A River Runs Through It, Sleepers, 12 Monkeys. Right. I don't have on my list, which is just
Fight Club. Neither one of us had on our list.
Snatch, Spy Game, The Mexican, California, The Oceans Trilogy. The guy's done a lot of very interesting stuff, and he
right.
And it's now that he's finally getting the credit that he deserves because, you know, he was too good-looking for too long, and everybody loves to cut down the good-looking guy. And it happened with Robert Redford. Robert Redford was a respected actor, and he was well-loved, and people loved him. But, you know, people loved – if you go back and read reviews of some of Robert Redford's movies, you know, they could have been a little bit nicer at times. I think that, you know, and if there ever was a guy who feels like he's becoming Robert Redford – or could be become Robert Redford, it's Brad Pitt. So,
dude, his performance in Moneyball has Robert Redford written all over it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really does. That's why, I mean, for as much as I may not care for the movie as much as others did, Brad Pitt's performance in that film is amazing. And, I mean, that's one of the big reasons why I rewatch it a lot. I mean, plus Philip Seymour Hoffman and Jonah Hill are great. And I do love Arliss Howard's cameo. And it as well. I think that's kind of a fun nod to the Sandlot. But
look at him in Spy Game when he was paired with Robert Redford. He's like a fitting image for him. Tony Scott knew so well to put the two of them together in a spy film. So, and I always love Spy Game. The first 10 minutes of Spy Game is just amazing. It's all visual. It's beautiful. Like when he gets nabbed, I love the opening of Spy Game. So.
Yeah, that's a goodie for sure.
So get into your top five Cameron Diaz.
All right. My top five Cameron Diaz was probably the most uninspired list I've made. I did get a little more into it as I was looking over her filmography.
Yeah. She's done some stuff.
Yeah, she's done some stuff. So without any further ado, my top five Cameron Diaz is number five, going with her staple, There's Something About Mary. Movie that put her on the map. That, I mean, she is who she is in a part due to the fact of that film. I don't love that film as much as most people do. I think my favorite part of that is Matt Dillon. All right, so my number... With the teeth. I mean, I love Matt Dillon and everything, but my number four is Very Bad Things. I think that film is really good, and it's very dark, and I enjoyed it the first time I saw it late at night on cable when I was still in probably high school or middle school. I can't remember when that came out and was on cable, but I saw that young, and I remember watching it late at night, and I thought it was awesome. And, I mean, I still enjoy it to this day. I think that's a very fun and dark movie. My number three is Any Given Sunday. I think she's ferocious in that, and I do genuinely enjoy her performance in Any Given Sunday. I think she's perfect, and I think her and Pacino play off of each other rather well. And she's very good in that. My number two is going to be The Counselor, the ultimate femme fatale. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from her or the film. If there is a weakest link in the cast, I'm not as blown away by Cameron Diaz as I am with the other members of the cast, but I will say the more I watch it, the more I love it. I love her platinum fingernails and how she just kind of slinks around in the film and kind of knows what's going on with everything. I love the wrinkles on her face where you can tell she's lived a life in the sun. It's perfectly suiting for her character. I love her cheetah print tattoo that starts at her shoulder and goes down to her ass. I mean, she's fantastic. She's fantastic in The Counselor. She perfectly plays that character. And then my number one for Diaz is going to be Being John Malkovich, her most stripped down it's her most stripped down role where she's not the beautiful object of the main character's affection. I think she's hilarious in Being John Malkovich, and I think she gives a very touching and strong yet crazy performance. So that's my top five, Diaz. I know you like her. So
yeah, I've been a fan of Cameron Diaz forever. I think she's adorable, and I think she's been sexy. I think she's been cute. I think that she's been underrated at times. I think that she's made a lot of crap too. But my top five is number five is a tie. This is the only tie I have in this one, so you can breathe easy. I have Something About Mary and The Mask. The Mask is the first time that I saw her in a film, and I still think it's one of the hottest that she's ever looked as an actress in any movie. I don't know how well you remember The Mask or what kind of, you know, enjoyment level that movie brought to you. I love that film.
I like it.
Yeah, just a really fun movie. It was one I saw in the theater back in the day, and I remember her just being impossibly sexy when you first saw her in that red dress, and the camera pans from her, literally from her toes all the way up to her head. It was such a great introduction. And then in Something About Mary, such an iconic role, you know, blew her up, made her a star. How can you really say no? You know, that movie is fun. It's cute. I saw it, you know, tons of times that summer when it came out when I was like 17. You know, it was the movie to see. So those two tie for my number five. Number four is her psycho bitch role in Vanilla Sky. Absolutely love that film. I can't wait for the Blu-ray to come out in a couple of weeks. She's playing the girl that you want to be with, but you know you shouldn't be with because she's just a little crazy. And I thought that she did such a great job playing this really nasty, this crazy girl. I loved it. It's a small part, but it was really memorable for me. Number three would be her work in Being John Malkovich. As you said, hysterical performance, touching, emotional, sad, funny, stripped down, no makeup, the frizzy hair, the monkey, the chimp holding her, everything about it is just so funny. I love when she says he's got to go change his diaper. He doesn't feel good. I got to go sit with him. Like, it's just so funny. And she really grabbed that role and didn't care. And, you know, I always love when an actor or an actress has been made up to be a sex symbol and has been promoted by the media to be something for people. And then they're just like, fuck it. I'm going to shred my image and I don't care. So she's willing to do, she doesn't do it as often as maybe I'd like her to do it, but she's capable of it, knows that it's in her. And I really enjoyed that performance. Number two is her work in a movie I know you haven't seen, and I really do recommend that you see it. Curtis Hanson's In Her Shoes. It's one of my favorite movies, my favorite chick flicks, if you will. I hesitate to even call it really a chick flick because it's so much more than what that phrase, you know, connotates. It's a great story about sisters, about longing, about finding somebody that you can trust and believe in. Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz had fantastic chemistry. Curtis Hanson, yet again, you know, demonstrated his touch for humanistic stories and for telling adult stories that make sense and don't, you know, cheapen things. I really loved her performance in that movie. She's really sexy at times, but then she really gets emotional. There's some great scenes with her, I'm trying to remember the actor's name, but some wonderful scenes with her and an older man that just make me cry all the time. I just really love that movie. I think it's underrated. I think it should have done more money than it did at the box office. And my number one definitely is her role in The Counselor. It just completely blew me away. If it wasn't her doing the full split, she at least had something to do with that car scene in The Counselor, and that for me will go down as one of the ultimate movie moments of my lifetime, seeing her with that car. I've never seen anything like that in a movie. The idea that Cormac McCarthy even had to make that scene occur is wild. The way that she threw herself into the role, I loved. You know, you brought it all up. The unafraid to show the wrinkles, not really caring about how nasty she was going to come off, the leopard prints going down to her butt, the whole thing. I love the scene where she's talking to Penelope Cruz about, you know, you want to know how much your ring costs, and I know all about it. And she's right, you know, she's like pretty much right on the money because you've heard about the diamond from Bruno Ganz. I just love it. I think she's great. She's the ultimate serpent. She's one of the best modern femme fatales in a neo-noir. And it's a performance for me that I just love looking at her in that movie. Such a bitch. So, and then, like you said, Very Bad Things. I watched that movie a million times. She's tons of fun there. Any Given Sunday almost made my list. Love her in that movie. Perfectly cast. Some smaller ones from back in the day. Feeling Minnesota. She's the one. Those were two other ones that she made early on in her career that I enjoyed. Feeling Minnesota. Did you ever see that one?
I have not.
It's a fun one. Vincent D'Onofrio, Keanu Reeves, the guy who made it, never went on. It was post Pulp Fiction, and it was like, you know, quirky, violent comedy, dark, and it was in that vein of like low budget sort of pseudo independent, you know, movies that were coming out at the time. It was like 96 or something. It's kind of underrated, it's kind of fun. And then I love her little role in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, of course. So
yeah, I was gonna ask you, have you seen a film called Head Above Water? That almost made my list, too. I almost put it as a tie for number five. It came out in either the mid or early 90s, and it has her. It's a small cast of her, Harvey Keitel, Billy Zane, and Craig Schiffer, and it's kind of like this bumbling romantic.
Yeah, you know, I've never seen it.
It's pretty good. It's hard to track down. I looked it up on Amazon, and the DVD is out of print, and it's like $30. I wouldn't buy it for $30, but if you saw it somewhere cheap, I'd pick it up. It's a fun movie, and I haven't seen it in a while, and I definitely want to give it a revisit, but it's just difficult to track down. So
nice.
Yeah, my list got easier as I looked at her filmography and realized she was actually, you know, she was in some pretty good stuff, and she did a very good job.
Yeah, so. She just, you know, there's just a lot of poop in there, you know, like a lot of really stupid, you know, silly things and whatever. I mean, you know, who's not going to take $2 or $3 million to hang out for 8 weeks and make a simple movie when you're, you know, when you're getting asked to do it? But she's proven in my head to be able to be capable of a great performance when she's been asked to do it by a good filmmaker. So anything you want to throw on to the end of the show? Anything notable that you saw throughout the week? I know we're getting sort of long, but anything you want to let our viewers know that they should pay attention to?
Yeah, I just recently bought the Mondo exclusive Steelbook Blu-ray of True Detective Season 1 that's only available at Target. And I'm glad I never bought that on Blu-ray prior.
I'm
still waiting for
mine. Yeah.
Yeah, I went to the store on Tuesday and picked it up, and I watched the first couple episodes, and I mean, I've seen that first season probably 10 times, and it's fascinating on Blu-ray. It's the first time I've seen it on Blu-ray. I really haven't picked too much up or watched much. I did watch, what's the David Chase film that you suggested
to me?
Yeah,
Not Fade Away.
Not Fade Away. I liked it. I didn't love it. I'll rewatch it again when I'm more focused. I was a bit distracted when I was watching it. But, you know, I pretty much watched The Counselor all week. And this weekend, I'm going to check out Two Lovers, and I'm really going to try and watch After Dark, My Sweet.
Nice. Yeah,
so that's kind of what I have on my agenda. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I watched a bunch of stuff. The best thing I saw all week, and I would definitely want to just throw a quick little plug to this movie. It's a British film that was made in the Philippines. It's called Metro Manila, and it's available to be seen via Amazon. You can stream it, or if you have a Region 2 Blu-ray player, you can pick up a Region 2 Blu-ray on Amazon UK. And it is a very intense social drama thriller. It's about a poor farming family, who comes out. They leave their northern Philippines lifestyle, and they head to the big city, to Manila, to try to find work and try to find a better life for their children. And almost immediately upon getting to the big city, they're taken advantage of, and they learn how hard it's going to be to, you know, make ends meet. And the husband and wife have to make decisions about what they're going to do for work and money. And just an absolutely gripping, suspenseful, surprising, you think you know where it's going, it doesn't go in that direction. The performances from the people, you know, from an unknown cast are just exquisite. Sean Ellis, who wrote and directed the film, co-wrote the film and directed it. He also acted as his own cinematographer and camera operator, which just made it even more amazing because the movie has an incredible visual style. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's one of my favorite movies I've seen all year. And then one of my other favorite movies of the year came out as well, Spring, which is this really cool, trippy science fiction romance, an independent film, a duo set of directors, two young guys just really made a thoughtful film that is visually very creative. Has a wonderful atmosphere. It takes place in Italy. It's all about a mentally crushed young man who, after his mother dies, he heads out to Italy to sort of get some life experience and try to put everything in the past. And he meets the woman, girl of his dreams, but she's got a big secret, and I won't say anything more. It's just awesome. It's romantic. It's sexy. It's got great special effects that are relying more on the practical than on the CGI. And it's got a fantastic ending that I never saw coming. So two really great movies that people could catch up with that are smaller, have a lower profile than most, but that are very much worth checking out. So, and as usual, I've got a full roster of stuff to look out for this week, either on disc or saving up on the DVR. I've been taping a whole bunch of movies left and right. You're definitely going to have fun with After Dark, My Sweet. I finally had a chance to see that last week and thoroughly enjoyed it. So
yeah, I can't wait to watch that. That looks fantastical. I love Bruce Dern. I love sleazy Bruce Dern. God, I can't wait to watch that. Really excited.
Very nice. Oh, and I will say too, I was able to, no pun intended, pop my pop cherry with the toys, thanks to you.
Yes, you're welcome for that.
Finally had a chance to see a large display up close and personal, and I can tell that they will definitely be an addiction, considering that they are only $9 and that there are so many of these little pop toys that I love. I started off with Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, the Disney movie, which I've always loved, but I got the Stitch. He has the double ray gun blasters, so it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. I've bought so many that it's just, I haven't bought any in a while, but I did buy some Star Wars ones that were GameStop exclusives for May the 4th. Chewie on Hoth with snow all over his face, Han on Hoth, a droid from the prequels, and then one of the Cantina Band guys. So I've kind of slowed my roll on stuff with the whole buying movies to watch and collectibles, and, you know,
yeah,
homeboy's got to pay the bills here.
Yeah, I think ever since we started talking and ever since I was on Facebook meeting all these people online and getting all these recommendations, I've purchased more movies in my life than I ever have, so I've probably got to slow down a little bit.
Yeah, I second that emotion. So,
well, good stuff, man. Another great show.
Yeah, for sure. Next week for episode 10, 10 weeks, 10 episodes, we are going to be discussing Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York, which is another personal favorite of mine. And we are going to be doing the top 5 performances of Daniel Day-Lewis and Meryl Streep.
It'll be very exciting. Can't wait. Love Gangs of New York, and I can't wait to revisit it. It's been a while, so very, very excited.
Indeed. Thank you, everybody, for listening and continuing to listen. You guys are amazing. And Nick and I are still having a ball 9 weeks in. So can't wait to discuss Gangs of New York next week. So
Absolutely.
Everybody have a good one.
You too. Enjoy.